Coming up on this week's show, is it the beginning of the end of the Xbox 360?
A legendary adventure game series is back.
And we chat to Rare musical legends Grant Kirkhope and David Wise.
And the Retro Hour podcast is brought to you each and every Friday with our incredible friends at Bitmap Books. Now, have you seen A Guide to Japanese Role-Playing Games? Now, this is a book that features every major JRPG release across the last four decades. An unmissable resource for dedicated fans of the genre and, of course, the usual high-quality presentation that you expect from Bitmap Books. You can check that out and the rest of their retro gaming collection at bitmapbooks.com. And with our lovely friends at PCBWay. Now, they offer a fully featured custom PCB prototyping service, and they've got low-cost, fast turnaround quality boards, and they offer services like 3D printing and injection molding. And of course, you know that PCBWay are big supporters of the retro community, so get an instant quote for your project right now at PCBWay.com. Hello and welcome to the Retro Hour podcast, episode number 393. Your weekly dose of retro gaming and technology news with me, Dan Wood.
Me, Ravi Abbott.
And me, Joe Fox.
And really nice of you joining us for another hour-ish of retro gaming and technology goodness, where of course we're going to bring you veterans of the industry onto the podcast to hear their story and keep you up to speed on all the big happenings in the world of retro from over the last 7 days. And you know, of course, the sounds I play at the start of the show. If you recognise this, then this is a podcast for you. What was that then, Joe?
Blowing your cartridge. Is either
of course it was. Yeah.
I was going to even try and guess what console it was.
That sounds like an NES.
Contra free. Oh, no, it's for SNES.
I've got to give a shout to SaveTheSounds.info, which is a website I ripped that off. Nice. Unfortunately, it's only audio, so I'm not sure which console it was. Must admit, these are getting harder now, so we'll see how many more of these I can do. But of course, it is a podcast where we do get all nostalgic, and we keep it to speed on what's been happening in the modern day as well, because, I mean, there's lots of new stuff coming out in the retro realm, so all of that coming up in a second. And I can't believe it is our first show of September. Does that kind of mean summer's over here in the UK?
Yeah, and we're approaching that 400th episode as well, aren't we?
That'll be just about a month from now, middle of October, I think that's going to land. We're obviously making plans behind the scenes for that, but we have actually been very busy over the summer, because you might remember that at the back end of last year, that was when we ran a Kickstarter for our book. Now, it has been a while since we talked about the Retro Hour book on the show. I mean, for people that maybe are new listeners, Joe, and give them a bit of a reminder on what this is.
So, put me on the spot here, mate. So, we had the crazy idea early last year to document and kind of like preserve in physical form some of our favourite interviews and kind of build a little bit of a history from our interviews, kind of the gaming industry, really. So we painstakingly decided to write a book, and obviously it's got lots of added extras in there. We've got five bonus interviews going into it now, as well as, you know, personal written articles and all the intros and, you know, kind of like box outs and stuff like that, all written by us, you know, all brand new for the book as well.
So many pictures. So many.
Lots of pictures. And it's been really nice as well, because we've managed to use, you know, like local suppliers and local photographers and stuff like that. So, you know, the money hasn't all just gone, you know, to us or anything like that. Or, you know, it's all gone into the book.
And there's not much left over for us.
Yeah. And it's, you know, we've used like local artists and stuff like that.
Yeah, people from the industry as well, haven't we? We've supported, you know, we've licensed a lot of photos from photographers who've worked in the video games industry, for example. So, I mean, we've really put, you know, most of the money we earn back into this, if we're honest. Yeah. But it's something that we wanted to do because, I mean, we've talked about before the fact that, you know, podcasts are something that it kind of feels like the difference between having an album pressed onto vinyl versus on Spotify, doesn't it?
Yeah. It's something physical to hold as well. And we've kind of added a lot of bonus interviews, which is awesome. You know, you're getting some extra stuff there as well if you backed it. And there's one thing we had to keep out, though, which was Dan's dedication to his dog.
Ran out of room.
I know that was important. I'm sorry, Winston. To you, Dan.
He's looking at me now, those big sad eyes.
Thank Winston now. But it is at the proofers now. So
it's done.
So it's going to be coming soon, folks. And it's good that that's all kind of wrapped up, because we can move on to other stuff like concentrating on the 400 and making this podcast awesome.
Yeah, so really the big news is that it's at the proofreaders at the moment. And basically, if you did back it on Kickstarter, you should have received your backers survey this week. You know, to put your address details in there. We ask everyone that's done that gets it done by September 17th. So then hopefully, you know, it's going to get the printers hopefully next month. And then we can get it into your hands, you know, before the end of the year. So it's a really good place to be. I mean, we did have a lot of people ask us, didn't we, when the Kickstarter finished, like, damn, I missed out on it. Is there any way that I can get hold of a copy of the book? Obviously, we're going to send them out to all the backers first and then kind of see what's left. We're hopefully going to get a few extra ones printed as well. So fingers crossed, there will be a chance for other people to get them at some point as well. But obviously, it's been a hell of a journey. You know, it's taken us a best part of this year, working night and day to get this book ready. And I think I speak for all of us, and there's Simon, who's helped us with it as well, that we're really, really proud of the end result. And we know that you're going to love it. So if you did back it, thank you so much for that. Now, of course, we have got an incredible podcast for you this week. And this is actually from Ravi's Travels when you were out in Norway last weekend.
Yeah, this isn't me just describing Oslo and walking around. This is a panel from Retro Messer, and we've got two absolute musical legends here from Rare. You've got Grant Kirkhope, and Grant actually traveled from Los Angeles to do this panel, and we have David Wise as well. And these guys, you know, they worked on some amazing titles together, and there's, you know, a few games like Banjo Kazooie and you know, Perfect Dark and Star Fox Adventures, Viva Pinata, quite a few. And we're kind of talking about how they got into the video game music and how they started their career and what the kind of path is, and also stuff like, do you need formal training? You know, getting advice from these guys is really good. And it's really interesting because, you know, Grant, he's done a lot of stuff that we've not really talked about on the podcast before as well. So recently he did Mario Plus Rabbids Sparks of Hope. There was Civilization he's done the score for. He's done
Super Smash Brothers,
the score for movies as well. And David also does, you know, his music is very, I'd say, from different cultures. You know, he looks for different backgrounds and he adds that into video games. And it's usually not the kind of sound that you associate with a video game, but it works so well. And it's, you know, all about getting the correct melodies and that composition. And that's what we're going to be talking about on this panel. And it's really cool because I love live panels and I love, you know, audience questions as well.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you talk about the music David's done. I mean, we've had David on the podcast a few times. I mean, he's a good friend of the show. Actually lives here in Nottingham, just down the road from where I am, actually. And if you remember games he worked on, for example, you know, the Donkey Kong Country series, how incredible the music is on those. And obviously, we've done episodes talking all about those games before. But this one is something quite different. Yeah, really, it's kind of, if you've ever had an interest in how these musicians have worked for massive companies like Rare and who worked on your favorite games growing up, how they kind of entered the industry and their kind of influences and what they use to build these tracks. I mean, it's quite an interesting talk, you know, the technical side of it and the business side.
Yeah, and this was done a day after they did a performance on stage, which was, you know, the whole Rare band, they had Kev Bayliss there as well. And it was quite funny. They were dressed as like Axl Rose, you know, all these kind of like old 80s metalers. And I saw GoldenEye live with Grant Kirkhope playing and Dr. David Doak in his kind of doctor uniform, like his character inside GoldenEye. And it was just absolutely awesome. And they did some live drawing as well. They were doing Donkey Kong Country music, and Kev Bayliss was actually drawing, and then it was getting projected on a screen and stuff. And it was something really nice to see. There were some of the Japanese composers there, and they were all, you know, getting involved and drinking and enjoying it. And really good night. So they might sound a little bit croaky, but it's still a fantastic panel.
I think it was your second day there. You might be a bit croaky in this one as well.
Oh, right? God, yeah.
No, you all sound great. It was a really good panel, actually, and there's more of them to come. So if you couldn't make it out to Norway to Retro Messe, don't worry. We're going to bring it to your ears. That panel coming up, the Rare musical legends, Grant Kirkhope and David Wise, on the show in around 40 minutes from now. But of course, before that, we have lots of new stories to bring you up to speed with in the first half of the podcast. That's what we do. We cast our eyes over the big headlines so you don't have to. You know, we're the ones that Google around and sit there on Facebook and Twitter or X, whatever it's called now, looking at the news throughout the week. And this one, I must admit, it's weird because I was on another podcast last week. Sorry, guys, for cheating on you. But this is, you know, it's good mates of ours. Console Shock. I know you've been on there as well, right?
Oh, yeah. Great podcast.
Yeah, they do brilliant. I think I've been on there about four times now. But yeah, I mean, I was on last week and actually we spent quite a bit of the podcast at the beginning, kind of being amazed that, you know, some of the systems that we probably don't consider all that old are actually knocking on for like two decades of age now, which is nuts. Because, I mean, the Xbox 360, I think that turns 20 in about 18 months.
Yeah.
Start of 2025.
I think it's the end. I want to say October, November 2025.
Right. Maybe 20 about 2 years then, yeah.
Yeah.
We haven't got long. And I've got to admit, I mean, I do still play quite a lot of Xbox 360 games. I don't have my 360 set up anymore, but I generally play them all via backwards compatibility on the Xbox One, which obviously we'll get into in just a moment. But the fact that it does kind of feel like a console that wasn't all that long ago, that was kind of my main system. Probably because that generation was quite long as well. But now there is some news that it looks like Microsoft are maybe getting ready to retire the, I was going to say old reliable, but that probably wouldn't be an appropriate phrase for the Xbox 360. Red Ring of Death. But it turns out that now this might be the beginning of the end of the Xbox 360, this news that we spotted over the last couple of days.
Yeah, so the main news really is the Xbox 360 store is going to be shutting down, which they officially announced earlier this week. And it's interesting because I should have seen this coming because about a month ago, you know, the Games with Gold service, they do alongside Game Pass, or which is part of the Ultimate Game Pass, you know, just your gold service to play online. They've always given you free games, about two or three free games a month with that. And they sent an email out about a month ago saying they're no longer going to give out a free Xbox 360 game. It's only for Xbox One and Series X games now. But you can still, you know, use your Xbox 360 to download and, you know, play games and stuff like that. But we should have seen this really coming. So they announced, Xbox 360 store is going to be shutting down. They've given quite a long time on it, which is good. So it's going to be going July 29th, 2024. So just
for nearly a year.
So just under a year away, which will make it just short of 19 years old when they finally take it out the back door and put a bullet through its head. But
a brutal way to describe it.
Yeah, but interestingly, they're not shutting down their online servers or anything like that. So they're saying while the Xbox 360 titles will no longer be available online purchase on the console they were originally designed for, you will still be able to download these games if they're backwards compatible into your Xbox One and your Xbox Series X. Yeah. So these games aren't gone forever if they're backwards compatible. And as well as that, you will still be able to, if you already own these games, you will be able to download them, etc. You know, re-download previously purchased content and connect with friends on the Xbox 360. So although the store is shutting down, you will still be able to re-download the games you already own, which is nice. However, I can't imagine they will keep that going forever.
There's been an interview in Eurogamer with Phil Spencer, who's the head of Xbox. And he said, you know, there's a list of 222 games that are not back compatible. And I have that list stapled to my forehead. And I think, how can we still play them? So he's talking about, you know, the challenges of preserving it on older hardware, making sure that works. But he says, how about having some of those on the PC or having it delivered in another way? So, you know, these games might exist, as you said, like later on the other Xbox systems, but just not be able to hit the 360. And I can imagine if they come out on the PC, blatantly, they're going to get like ripped and then put back onto the Xbox somehow by hackers.
To me, this is a really interesting one because, I mean, obviously we had that news that we covered, was it about a year, maybe longer ago, you know, when Sony were going to shut down the PS3 store.
Yeah.
And then they suddenly, massive backlash, and they were, we'll leave it up a bit longer then. And you can still play the PlayStation 3 online now, I believe. But obviously we know that Nintendo shut down the Wii U. That has been shut down. The 3DS as well, I believe, is gone now. Back in March this year.
The Vita.
So Yeah, and the Vita as well has gone, obviously. But for 360, it's a bit different because when I read this headline at first, I was a bit like, oh, thank God I downloaded some of my DLC for 360 games the other day, because my brother and I were playing Call of Duty Modern Warfare 2, you know, the original one, not the new version of it, and Modern Warfare 3, booted it up on my Xbox One that I've got in this room here, and it went online and actually downloaded all the DLC, all the map packs that I'd bought, you know, God, 10, 11 years ago. So I was able to do that. And when I read this, I thought, God, you know, you're not going to be able to do that for much longer. But it turns out, yeah, like you said, Joe, if you've bought this stuff, they're going to give you a way to download it. But I think the difference here is, because you know they killed off the original Xbox service for the OG Xbox only about 8 years after it came out. It wasn't very long. Mm. But because you can play so many of the Xbox 360 games via backwards compatibility, and it does still use the same servers. So if I play an old Xbox 360 game on my Xbox Series X, and I've got a friend who plays it on his 360, you can play those together. It's using the same Xbox Live service. So to me, this, it kind of feels like they're not supporting too much additional infrastructure, whereas maybe Sony, I think they, you know, they've got a dedicated service that is just for PlayStation 3.
Maybe
it's just costing their money to keep that running.
Maybe it's just that they're really good at like collecting the gamer tags, and what, you know, you said you downloaded it and it had all your maps and stuff, and having that consistency on the Microsoft system and digital like platform will help, you know, it move on to another console. But personally, I remember the Xbox Live Arcade was one of the first kind of things where I was purchasing games online and downloading them to the system. And, you know, not just playing like multiplayer kind of online titles, I was downloading it from a store and it was arriving onto my console. And that was the kind of groundbreaking for the 360. I was like, wow, you can get all these like cheap little games, and there's quite a few arcade conversions and stuff. And it's kind of nice that he's talking about preserving all of those.
Yeah, and I think the way I see it is the fact that people still play Xbox 360 games today, probably more so than they play PlayStation 3 games, for example. Because my brother told me, you know, when we went on to play Modern Warfare 2 the other day, he said, oh, everyone's playing that again now. He said, have you not seen it? It's like a meme.
Yeah.
You know, everyone suddenly is, for some reason, it's like even people are going out and buying a copy of it for like £2 and playing it for like, whether it's quirky reasons or I don't know.
Yeah, I saw that on Facebook and Instagram, and I saw a thing about it on Reddit. But yeah, like millions of like people have started playing Modern Warfare 1 and 2 and World at War and Black Ops and stuff like that on 360 again.
Probably via modern consoles though.
Yeah, I imagine because I'm in a lot of the kind of buying and selling groups as well on Facebook. And, you know, lots of people were like pointing out that the CEX stores, for those who don't know, secondhand game shops in the UK, CEX were like putting up these games, which are £2, are all of a sudden like £12, £8, and stuff like that, because they'd cottoned on to it and they've probably got millions of copies of them on the shelves.
I was kind of amazed when I first heard this that, you know, the Xbox still had a store, but then also the compatibility with Xbox, you know, the fact that you can link them all together and still kind of play a game just shows like, you know, Microsoft, they must have been working on the same architecture or just kept the same standard or kept updating it, which is really good. I don't know many other kind of consoles that do that.
That's one thing you've got to commend them for. Yeah, the fact that they do really respect kind of the older machines, even though you might not be able to buy them anymore. The fact that people are still keeping these titles active via emulation on newer Xboxes, I think, will probably mean that these games have a longer lifespan than PlayStation 3 games. So, I mean, I can't see them actually shutting down the 360 Live service for many years.
I guess
hopefully.
You can keep all your achievements and stuff like that.
Exactly. Yeah, it carries over. Yeah, which is a good thing. So, it is a bit sad that you're not going to be able to buy new digital games, for example, on the 360. I'm not sure how many people kind of do that now, particularly with the price of, you know, most 360 games came out physically anyway. And they're so cheap, aren't they, generally, to buy them? I mean, you know, I was in CEX in Leeds over the weekend, they're like £2 or £3, a lot of these AAA games.
It's quite a good system to collect for, actually, nowadays.
Yeah, good time to do it. But yeah, I mean, it just kind of seemed like, you know, they're kind of phasing out that hardware, which is fair enough. You know, it's not enough for 20 years old, but obviously there are still ways to play most of the games via modern systems. So yeah, we'll keep an eye on that story and keep you up to date. Now, let's talk about this. Now, this is something that we covered on the podcast a couple of years ago. You guys did a great interview with Charles Cecil when you were talking about the Broken Sword series. Now, these were classic adventure games from back originally started in, was it 95, 96, the original one came out? And we've had some very nice news for fans of Broken Sword in the last couple of days.
Yeah, there's a, it looks like there's a new game coming out, and there's also a remaster as well. And, it, you know, Charles is involved in this as well. And it's great to have the kind of original team on board. And Broken Sword's always had that kind of hand-drawn, hand-illustrated look, you know, and that kind of cartoonish look. Now, this looks like it's been developed a bit more. You know, they're using modern shader and modern standards, but it's still, to me, got that real kind of Broken Sword feel to it.
Yeah, it's going to be Percival Stone, which they've just said they haven't done a release date for it yet because it's not going to, but they have confirmed it will come out after the remaster of the original game.
Yeah, which is Shadow of the Templars Reforged, because it's about the Knights Templar and you know, the kind of myths behind that mystery.
But yeah, the graphical style that you just touched on there, they're calling it Super 2D, which is quite interesting.
I like that name.
Yeah, so the graphic style, Super 2D, that's a style that applies hand-drawn backgrounds to 3D geometry. Can't say it.
3D geometry.
Yeah. 3D geometry. For a more cinematic experience. I'm not a massive Broken Sword guy. Obviously, the look of Broken Sword, I can see it in my mind's eye right now, the original game, and getting pushed over by that damn goat. I don't know if this looks a bit too clean, but obviously they've got it's different. They've got to go somewhere with it. They've got to modernize it. Do you know what I mean? And it does look nice. I'm not going to sit here and say it doesn't look nice, but it is a bit strange because of the 2D sprites, you know, your characters, they look like they've got a slightly different graphical style to the background, which I guess is a purposeful look. But yeah, it looks interesting, and apparently it's going to be pretty damn brutal with its difficulty. But I know the Broken Sword games can be like that.
I think, you know, you saying cinematic is exactly the word that describes the Broken Sword series. And also, when it came out, it was one of those first ones that used, you know, that high-end graphics and that much kind of voice acting and, you know, had a lot of elements in there. And as the series went on, the graphics changed and increased in a definition and also changed in style a bit as well. So I think this does really, really kind of fit it. And, you know, I've seen a lot of kind of modern redos of versions, or this is called a reforged version. You know, some of them have really not hit the mark. And this one, to me, looks like it's really fitting in with the genre.
And it's nice to see that, yeah, they're doing a brand new installment then. So Percival Stone, that's a new game, completely from fresh, new game. I think the last one, looking at the list here, was in 2013.
Yeah.
So first new Broken Sword adventure game in a decade. And then they're doing a reboot of the original game, which I think this is actually maybe the second or third kind of attempt to kind of do an HD upgrade of it. There was a director's cut that apparently came, I didn't see this, but it came out in 2009, which was a kind of an HD version of it. But I've read reviews of that today that a lot of people saying they didn't really like that version because it cut quite a bit out.
I played the original on Scum VM as well. But, you know, obviously the resolutions are really low.
Yeah, well, I mean, it looks like this is, you know, we've only got a few seconds of it in this trailer, but really it looks like just an HD upgrade of the original game, from what I can see, you know, hopefully with the full introduction sequence and all that was apparently missing from the director's cut that came out back in 2009. So, again, I think you're right, Ravi, having the original team behind it, having Charles involved, that's so important, isn't it, to kind of keep the storyline going and make sure it actually feels like a game from this series.
Yeah.
It, you know, obviously something that's been going that long, it's got a lot of hardcore fans. So
They did you know, Revolution, they did that Beyond a Steel Sky as well.
Which I still haven't played. I bought that last year at Retro Messer, I think.
Which, looking at the style of this as well, seems quite similar. Obviously it's in a sci-fi environment and world, and it's less kind of cartoony, but the way that the shading's done in it, it looks quite similar to that.
Yeah, and the fact they're working on, you know, essentially two games at once, I imagine they're quite busy right now, so we'll keep an eye on that as we get closer to the release date. We're going to check out that trailer. I'll put that in, of course, the rest of the stories. You can check them out every week on your podcast app. Check the show notes or head to our website at theretrohour.com. Now I can hear Joe almost squealing with excitement to get to this next story.
Squealing with pain. I'm not going to lie.
Yeah, I'm squealing with rage.
Squealing with rage. I mean, the bottom line, this is cool. This is really cool. So Arcade 1UP have announced Time Crisis Deluxe, their latest, you know, three-quarter scale pop-up arcade machine for your home. It's just wicked. Absolutely awesome. Time Crisis. We've got the light guns. We've got two light guns, which we'll get onto in a minute, because the first Time Crisis game was only one player. It's Time Crisis. What more can I say? We've got the pedal on there. It looks wicked.
Whenever you go to an arcade and you're with Joe, if he vanishes and there's a Time Crisis machine, you know exactly where it's going.
That's the only one that I got into, but that and Point Blank, which is also on this.
Spoilers. But yeah, I mean, the decals on the side, everything about this, it looks so 90s. It's awesome. You know, you've got the Time Crisis dude on the side. I don't actually know his name. And I'm assuming it's the same similar technology to the Sinden light gun, because obviously it's going to be an LCD screen in there. And like I say, you've got the pedal, you've got the red and the blue gun, which have got the awesome electronic recoil on there as well.
The absolutely tiny pedal that you'll probably break as well. Because I remember the Time Crisis one was big. If you've got two people going on that for the reload as well, that's going to get hammered, isn't it?
That is going to get hammered. But yeah, got, like I say, two gun cons on there. Time Crisis 1 was only one player, so I assumed, because Arcade 1UP do this, they do put, you know, three or four, they will base it on one game and then they'll put like another four in that one cabinet. But as you say, Ravi, we've got Point Blank on there, and then Steel Gunner 1 and 2. Never played Steel Gunner games personally.
No, me neither.
But yeah, the downfall is the eye-watering price tag that does come with this pre-order of $750. Which,
I mean, look, there's light gun technology in there, more than just a joystick.
Does it have recoil?
Yeah, it does. It does, yeah.
It has the recoil. Yeah. Okay, that's changed my mind a bit.
It's electronically powered recoil on there.
I pay more for the recoil, definitely, with that game.
But yeah, man, I mean, how much are the other Arcade 1UPs? They're between 200 and 450, depending on what cabinet it is. You know, I mean, a couple of them, mostly about 300 quid, the ones I see in the UK these days, because we do get them. We don't get as much as a selection as in America in the States. But yeah, I've not seen one. I think they did a Big Book Safari one. I feel like they might have done that, which might have been closer to this kind of cost, this price point. And as you say, Ravi, it is probably because of the light gun technology and what they've done with it.
And I think they must use a very small guy when they're doing the promo shots for this, because
we've said this before.
They're not going to have a big dude, because these machines, it's going to be hard to get that close and that tight in with that.
You put them on a table,
screen,
I guess, don't you?
You know, when they did the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles one, they had the wider kind of thing to have four people in, and that you're still really cramped up on that. Can't imagine what this one's going to be like with two people trying to stamp on each other's foot constantly.
I mean,
there was a big divide in the middle of the original, well, in Time Crisis 2, between the two players.
The only thing I can think of is that I've not played Steel Gunner, so I don't know if that uses a foot pedal to reload. But I know Point Blank, I don't think you even have a reload in Point Blank, you know, you just shoot the screen. You just go for it, depending on what mini game it is.
And some people were saying some of the screenshots are from the PlayStation version of the Time Crisis.
Oh, really?
And
not the arcades.
So they're not sure if it's going to be the PlayStation version or the arcades. Obviously, the arcades is what you want if you've got an arcade unit.
Yeah. And I'd say, if they're selling this as an arcade, and, you know, obviously there were home ports that not a lot of people play, but if I think of these Namco Light Gun Classics, I'm thinking, arcades. And I think that for that price, $750, if it's not the arcade versions, I imagine there might be a bit of a backlash.
Interesting, Ravi's just said that. I watched the trailer to this earlier on, and you literally see about 2 seconds of actual Time Crisis footage, and you're right, Ravi, you can actually see the analog, your reticle if you're using the analog sticks to play, or your
Point Blank was on the PlayStation as well, so I'm thinking
could be right with that one, Ravi. Oh dear.
I
still want it. Yeah, that's the bottom line.
Maybe now you said recoil.
I mean, how much are this? I mean, I know these aren't Sinden light guns. I mean, it was probably the same technology, but the Sinden-like ones, I think, are about, I want to say they're about £200 anyway.
I think they're quite expensive and they have recoil in it. But from what I've heard, they're totally worth it as well.
Yeah. This is, I mean, you're looking at their other ones. Tech, I mean, they've also announced that they're going to be doing a deluxe edition cabinets for Galaga, Street Fighter 2 and the Atari 50th anniversary. These cabinets are going to cost $500.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I imagine if you're factoring in maybe another 200 for the light guns, and kind of work
Terminator 2 one, which I think we did cover a while ago, $700. I don't think we had the price point of it, though.
Wait for one to come cheap on Facebook Marketplace and then repurpose it so I can play Crime Patrol with recoil. That would be
Mad
my
Dog McCree.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, that's the thing. I mean, it's, you know, often I'm not sure whether we ever even get UK releases of a lot of these anyway. I generally will see like US pricing. Mm. So, I mean, whether we'll even be able to get a hold of one, you know, if you have the cash to spare. But it is quite cool to see, you know, these games. I mean, I do think it is really important that it is the arcade version of these. Of, you know, if you've got an arcade cabinet, just being able to play, have the arcade experience with something that looks like this with the light guns in the home is a big selling point, I think, for me. So we'll link up that little trailer if you want to check it out. So far, no clarification on the exact versioning yet, but of course we will let you know. Now, we have got some more stories to tell you about in just a minute, including something very cool for my first computer, which for some reason seems to be getting a lot of love at the moment. So we'll talk more about that in just a moment. And also a way to upgrade your Sega Saturn 3D controllers. Now, before we do that, let's just take a second to talk about something that is so important to this podcast and really the reason that we're here all these years later, rapidly approaching episode 400. And that is thanks to our wonderful patrons community. Because, I mean, that is the lifeblood of this show, isn't it? Just really helps us out so much.
Yeah, 100%. Just the community and the support we get from the patrons has really, really, really kept the show alive. And, you know, I'll say it, I have had no end of issues with my computer and my kind of home studio set up this last kind of 2-3 months.
Joe has been ripping his hair out with the wireless.
God,
you don't want to know, guys.
It's been absolutely terrible. But because we have the Patreon and because we have the support, we're able to, you know, to fix these things, get these things, you know, pay for these things to be fixed and stuff like that, and sort them out. And, you know, we literally wouldn't have a show right now if it wasn't for that.
It's really amazing. Like, I went out to Norway and I hung around with a patron and we went out to Oslo and stuff, and he invited me into his house. You know, we had patrons coming up to us, you know, coming out for a drink as well. And it was just fantastic, the whole kind of community and all the people around the world as well. And it really helps the podcast, but also we kind of add some bonus stuff in there for you. So we've got the After Hours podcast, which we've just recorded one of.
Episode 37 that you can, we're talking about licensed games in the latest one, which if you join us on Patreon as a gold member or above, you'll get access to that from this weekend after I've edited it up. And also you get the usual podcast ad free. You get about 10, 15 minutes of extra news on every single episode. You get it early some weeks if I can get it turned around in time. And also you get access to our patrons only Discord section of the Discord server, which, you know, we're chatting away in pretty much every day on there, aren't we? We've got a great little community. And of course, a big thing that all patrons get invited to that we do usually on the last Sunday of every month. We've just had one, and that is the Patrons Hangout. This is where we invite all our patrons to come on, basically a massive video call where we all nerd out about all kind of things. And really, it's great because it's got a real international flavour to it, hasn't it? I'd say, you know, this week, probably half of our audience was from overseas, wasn't it, on the Hangout, which was just incredible to see. So if you'd like to get involved in that and become part of the Retro Hour Patrons community, all the details to sign up right now and support the show are at theretrohour.com. And of course, we induct new members into the most prestigious high score table in the world of retro gaming, and that is the Retro Hour Hall of Fame.
Hall of Fame.
And let's welcome our newest patrons. Thank you so much to Girolamo Castaldo,
Hakon Puntervold,
and Daniel Lukes,
who all joined us on Patreon over the last week. We massively appreciate your support, and all the details to join our wonderful patrons community are on the website right now at theretrohour.com. That is weird, because I remember getting my first machine when I was 7 years old. I've talked about this on the podcast before. You know, used computers at school, really wanted one at home, and then my mum got me a Commodore Plus 4. Now, at the time, when I was a kid, I didn't know the reputation that the Plus 4 had for generally being a bit of a naff machine. I mean, really, it was intended as a, you know, originally a really a business computer, really. And then they kind of sold them off at a fire sale. I think my mum got mine for about £99 with like 25 games included with it as well. I remember a lot of other kids at school getting them that Christmas too. So obviously they sell them off very cheap. But one thing you'd always find when you had a Commodore Plus 4 is the kind of few games that were ports of kind of big, you know, what we call AAA games right now, were generally a bit crap on the Plus 4. We've got stuff like, if you guys ever get a moment to check out the Commodore Plus 4 version of Paperboy on YouTube, it's not something you'd ever want to play for literally any amount of time at all. It's not even worth the cassette tape it came on. And I remember going to game shops and, like, you know, it got to a stage where really if you asked for Commodore Plus 4 games, the shopkeeper would generally sneer at you a little bit. And I remember one of them actually flat out telling me, I'd just throw your computer in the bin if I were you. So that's, it didn't have a great reputation. But the thing is, in recent months, I mean, there has been a scene around the Commodore Plus 4 and its younger sibling, the Commodore 16, which is basically just a Plus 4 in a Commodore 64 style case with 16K of RAM. But for some reason, the homebrew scene on this machine has just kind of blown up over the last couple of months. And there are people doing things that is just nothing short of amazing on these systems right now. Now, we've covered a couple of these in the news over the last couple of months, I think mainly in the patrons section. But now someone has actually ported the Jeff Crammond classic Stunt Car Racer to the Commodore Plus 4. And, you know, as someone who's owned a Plus 4 for, God, about 35 years now, I can't believe that this machine was capable of running something this well all this time. I mean, obviously, I imagine you're familiar with the original game, Ravi. I mean, what do you think of this new version?
I think this is well impressive. Like, from the stuff that we've seen with the Plus 4, it's just been a few sprites and it's been kind of...
Well, it doesn't even have sprites. Well, yeah, it's one, well, it doesn't have hardware sprites at all.
People attempting to do them and stuff, and seeing a full 3D track. You know, I've always thought Stunt Car Racer is like one of these games where it uses kind of minimal technology and it really pushes the system and... you know, the physics in there and how it runs. It's always kind of been a little test of, you know, your machine's power as well. A lot like later on Frontier, everyone would load that up and be like, oh, look, the intro is working better with an accelerator. But seeing something like this on a Plus 4, I would not expect it to be at this frame rate. You know, it looks very playable.
Yeah, really playable. And the thing is, there's everything in here you'd expect from it. Now, really, this is, it's a port of the Commodore 64 version. But the thing is, I mean, when we got 64 ports to the Plus 4 back in the day, they generally strip out a load of stuff.
Yeah.
Because it didn't have the hardware sprites. It doesn't have a SID chip. You know, they generally, it'd be a terrible port. But this thing here, I mean, it's pretty much, you know, I haven't played the 64 version all that much. I mean, I generally played it more on the Amiga back in the day. But from looking at video side by side, this almost feels like a, you know, a perfect port of the 64.
Yeah,
version. It's obviously with a few changes.
It's quite small. On the screen, you know, it's not a full screen title, but you know, you're gonna have one of these like letterbox windows if you're running something like this. But also, I don't know if it's the ghost car that's also running on there as well, or if there's another racer in there. I can't quite remember it. But I think it had a like ghost car that would go around and show you previous progression on the track, and seeing that as well on the Plus 4 is absolutely mental.
Yeah, I mean, the gameplay looks exactly as I remember it. And apparently all the cheats, you know, from the Commodore 64 version and stuff work on here as well. So, I mean, you know, it's pretty much reinterpreted code on there. The graphics have been changed to use the TED colors, because the Commodore Plus 4 was really one of the earliest kind of, what we call today, system on a chip. You know, the Raspberry Pi, like you've got the we call the GPU and the CPU, and they're all in kind of one little unit. So it was all on the what was called the TED chip. But there have been a few little things in here as well, which, you know, stuff like the Hall of Fame is loadable from disc or cassette tape now as well. So, you know, you don't lose your high score table. There's a lot in here. I mean, I'll link up the notes if you want to check it out as well. But really, I think the big news here is it is just insane to see what they're doing on the Commodore Plus 4 at the moment. Because, I mean, we kind of had this about 5-6 years ago, the Amstrad machines, didn't we?
Yeah.
People kind of making our jaw drop with ports that we didn't expect were possible on that.
Do you think a little Dan's mind would have been blown if he saw this back in the day?
And I wish I had this to show that smug shopkeeper who told me to throw it in the bin.
Yeah, there you go.
Look, you can run this. Look at you.
Angry shopkeeper. Yeah, I'm glad I didn't.
Yeah, so exactly. I'm glad I kept it all this. All I had to do is wait till 2023. But yeah, I mean, it does look really impressive. So that is available to download now for free if you want to see what the Plus 4 and Commodore 16, if you have 64K in your machine, is capable of. Stunt Car Racer is now playable on there. Now, this is something else that's really quite creative. And when I first read this headline, I was like, how on earth have they done this? Now, this is the Sega Saturn 3D control pad. Now, this was one of the earliest kind of controllers with an analog stick that I ever remember seeing. And I think this was actually designed pretty much exclusively originally for playing Nights into Dreams, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. You could actually get a like a box set with Nights into Dreams with it, you know, with the black Sega Saturn 3D controller. But yeah, this looks really interesting. So a modder, Geeky Fab, has created a USB-C adapter for it. Now, I'm ashamed to say I don't actually have the 3D controller for the Sega Saturn because they're pretty expensive. Oh,
call yourself a Sega fan.
I thought this would be your prized possession.
Yeah, I don't have one. They're getting pretty pricey. I know you have one, don't you, Dan?
Yeah, I got mine for about 15 quid about a decade ago.
Yeah, they're definitely a lot more than that now. But it seems they have like a, where the cable goes in, it's actually removable by the looks of things.
Yeah, I didn't know that.
Yeah, and it's got like a little clip that you push down and it removes the controller. Like, it's like a docking system, you know. Not too dissimilar from the Dreamcast controller, because the 3D controller, the Sega Saturn 3D controller, was kind of like, if you will, a bit of a prototype to the Dreamcast controller. Yeah. And it's interesting to see it's got this docking for the cable on the back where there's essentially like an inch by inch plastic square kind of comes out with the cable. And what he's done is he's built a USB-C adapter for that. And in this, like, it's only about a minute long, this video, but it then shows him off kind of like using this as a, you know, a modern controller. Now, obviously, he's not going to be able to play Call of Duty on it because we've not got any L and R buttons on there. And most notably, there is only the one analog stick on the left-hand side. But, you know, he's playing games such as Cuphead, you know, which only requires, you know, the one stick. And he's also emulating Super Mario, you know, on the NES. Yeah.
See Nintendo things running on a Sega pad.
Yeah.
Being played with a Sega pad blows my mind.
It's mad because it's like this tiny little device that you just clip in.
Mm. Yeah.
And I assume he's going to have power conversion in there coming from the USB-C and have it powered, you know, through that. And then he's going to have some kind of like little driver and translator that's then going to be picked up by, you know, Windows 10 or the Raspberry Pis.
Yeah.
All in this little tiny, you know, less than a memory card size little clip, and keeping it, you know, at £16 basically.
Yeah.
Which is just mad that someone can do this on their own, you know?
Yeah. And that's the mad thing. This is for sale. But like you say, it's for 2,980 yen, which is roughly £16 or $20, which is fantastic. It doesn't run on, so when I say modern systems, it doesn't run on Xbox or PlayStation by the looks of things, but it runs on Windows 10, 11, Raspberry Pi, Retro Freak, and stuff like that, which is cool.
And he's open sourced it as well. So, you know, someone might be able to do that in the future because he's put a PDF of the circuit board out there. So it's on GitHub and people can, you know, join in and kind of change it.
Which I think is cool because, you know, if he's putting the driver up on GitHub and the PDF of the circuit boards, I mean, like you said, Joe, it's only available from Japan at the moment.
Yeah.
Well, it's actually not available at all. You know, it's out of stock completely.
Oh, okay.
You can sign up for a restock. Yeah, you can sign up for a restock notice when out of stock in 7 days by the looks of it. I imagine cost of the price, anyone that's got a Sega Saturn and one of these and heard about it and lives nearby probably just bought them straight away. But hopefully that will mean that there can be kind of people making these in different parts of the world.
Yeah.
Which will be quite cool to see. I mean, I've got no need at all for this, but for some reason I want it. Because, I mean, I didn't even know. I'm ashamed to say, I mean, I've had this controller for, like I said, a decade. I always saw that little tab at the back, but I didn't know you could actually kind of remove the controller plug
from
the...
It's such a neat solution, isn't it?
Yeah. Because, I mean, I hadn't really seen that till, you know, when, God, probably the Xbox 360, you know, when that had, like, you know, you could plug a cable in or remove it. It's quite a bizarre addition to have that on something like the Sega Saturn to be able to unplug it, you know, something that isn't a wireless controller.
Yeah.
But obviously, for something like this, is really cool. So if you have got one of those controllers lying around and you want to put it to good use, these look very cool and very affordable as well. Now, while we're talking about things that are just, you know, completely bat crazy and people are doing just because they can, if you want to run Linux on your Commodore 64, Avi?
Not particularly, but I've got a feeling you're going to tell me that I can.
Yeah, well, you're a very patient person. Now, this is actually quite timely because I did see a post the other day. I put this on my my YouTube channel on the community section on there as well. A lot of screenshot that it was actually 30 years ago this week on the 26th of August that Linus Torvalds first went on to Usenet to announce Linux. So that is 30 years ago this week. Actually said it's a little hobbyist project. He doesn't think it'll get too big.
Yeah.
And I think now it's on pretty much every server in the world. But as we all know, you know, hobbyists love a challenge. So there was that story a while ago of them getting Linux running on an original Macintosh, an Apple Mac, which I thought was pretty nuts anyway. But now one developer, his name is Onno Kortman, and he's posted this on Slashdot. And now he's basically managed to get the Linux kernel booting on a 1982 Commodore 64 with the MOS Technology 6502 processor and 64 kilobytes of memory. Now, there's a video that you can watch as well. And at the moment, it looks like he was only doing this on an emulator, not original hardware, but they're saying that, you know, theoretically this should be possible.
Oh, no. So
because he uses, he's using the Vice emulator, which is a Commodore 64 emulator, and he uses warp mode in there, which basically makes it, you know, a hell of a lot quicker just because he didn't have kind of, you know, a week to wait.
Well, talking of that, taking a week for it to boot, I was chatting to John Bird, who's one of the contributors of our book. And he actually contacted me and said, have you seen a guy called Emule4? And he's actually streaming, booting Linux on a C64 for a week.
Right.
So he linked me to one of the videos, and it's 10 hours long. And only one part of it. But if you check out Emule4's channel, he's basically attempting to get this booting on real hardware and streaming the screen as it goes over a week with people just chatting. Some of the comments like, this is insanity. Wow. And, you know, just seeing how this live boot essentially is going to work.
I mean, you're not going to be running, you know, Ubuntu desktop on your Commodore 64, but the fact that you can basically, you know, get into a login, you know, there's...
I don't think you'll even be able to run any software on there, but you'll just be I'm in a Linux environment on the C64. There you go, world.
Exactly. That's the thing. I mean, the developer, Kortman, he's saying that there is actually a lot of room for improvement. He said there could be up to a 10 times speed up of this. So you might only have to wait, 2.5 days for it to load up rather than a week. But yeah, I mean, again, it's one of these things that there is no practical use for it at all. It's just cool, isn't it? You know, so someone's obviously decided that now it is possible to run Linux.
I'm just watching at the moment. He's just put a video. It took 2 days to boot Linux on a C64 video, and it's live at the moment. Maybe... by the time this podcast goes out, he may have booted it in 2 days. But check that channel out, because they're going constant, and you know, people are chatting and viewing it, and it's pretty hilarious, to be honest.
That's your weekend taken up now, isn't it, Ravi? Just staring at that.
Just like that moment that it boots, everyone's going to go, yeah.
Now, you know, we love crazy stuff like that. So more power to you. So if you want to check out that little article and the live stream as well, I'll chuck that down for you and put it in our show notes. You don't have to Google around. I'll save you the effort. All the details are at theretrohour.com. Now, we're going to be hearing Ravi's panel live with the rare musical legends, Grant Kirkhope and David Wise from Retro Messa in Norway in just a moment. Before we do that, I know you've had a long day at work today, Joe. 9-hour shift, was it, before you jumped on the podcast?
Yeah, nine, maybe. Well, probably out of the house for about 11 hours if you include travel and stuff like that. Long day.
That's the thing. When you get in the office in the morning, when there's so much to do. And actually, our friends, our wonderful sponsor this week, it's Notion. Mm-hmm. Now, the idea behind Notion is, you know, we love this service, and I must admit, I've been using this to help me out on a load of things. You know, I do social media management for a few clients, I have to do newsletters and that kind of thing, also my YouTube channel. This has been helping me out with quite a lot of that, because that is one thing that you'll find if you do any kind of office-based job or anything, you know, maybe run your own business or collaborate with teams, really. Just have a think about how many different tools you have to log into each morning. I mean, don't know about you, Joe, it's Google Docs has got to be open.
Yep. Gmail. Outlook. Teams.
Yeah. Microsoft Teams, yeah, as in Dropbox, Trello, Discord, Figma. Yeah, ChatGPT. I mean, I use that all the time. And actually, that can really help you out with this as well, because Notion is basically a single space where you can think, you can write, you can plan, you can capture your thoughts, manage projects, even run an entire company and do it the way you want. Now, rather than paying for all these different services that you use each month and trying to make them talk to each other, Notion keeps everything together in one tidy place. So it's just what you need in a world where there's too many services scattered across too many places, too many notifications as well. Aren't you sick of all those constant alerts on your phone and everything too? So this can be like to-do lists, you know, for you or your team, company goals, planners, marketing plans. The great thing about it is just how visually rich it is as well. You can embed images, videos, make gorgeous documents. You can do like, you know, team Wikipedia, your product roadmaps as well. You can even manage team-wide projects, track deals, onboard new employees. You can even publish articles directly to the web from here as well. And of course, like everything, all great services right now, they've got artificial intelligence built in as well. And what's more is Notion's got AI built into all of their tools. So that means it's across your notes, your documents, your planners. You don't have to jump out and, you know, log into ChatGPT. It actually automates all the tedious jobs in your day job, and you can focus on the things that you're best at. You know, it can even help you. One great thing I love about it is it can help you basically turn your messy brain farts, as we call it, into finished products just at the click of a button. So Notion AI helps you work faster, write better, and think bigger by doing tasks that normally take you hours in just seconds. Now, we're big fans of Notion AI, and I know whatever you do, it's going to really help you out, whether you work with a team or individually as well. So why don't you try Notion AI for free? And of course, by helping our sponsors, that really helps out the podcast as well. So take advantage of these offers. We'd really appreciate it. All you need to do is visit notion.com/retro. So that's all lowercase letters, notion.com/retro, and try out the incredible power of Notion AI today. And of course, use our link and you're supporting the podcast as well. Notion.com/retro, and I'll put that in our show notes as well. And a massive thank you to our friends at Notion for their support of our show. Okay, next we're crossing over to Norway for Ravi's panel last week, one of several panels we'll be bringing you over the next couple of months. This one really interesting with the musical legends of Rare, Grant Kirkhope and David Wise. That panel is coming up next on the Retro Hour podcast.
Hello, Retro Mesa.
Oh,
can you,
oh,
you hear me?
We're on.
Yeah, you're on. So I'm here with two absolutely legendary composers.
Legendary.
Where are they? We've got David Wise and Grant Kirkhope. How are you doing, guys?
Very well, how are you?
We're good.
Have you enjoyed the expo so far?
I have indeed.
Yes.
Yeah.
Had a great night at karaoke last night.
Oh, it an was. Amazing that gig as good. Well, if any of you saw that.
Great yeah. night at karaoke.
Cool. Thank you.
Yeah.
And if anybody missed that, on the 3rd of March next year in Stuttgart, we'll be doing the same thing, but bigger.
Yes. Oh, nice. And you're going to have more fancy dress as well.
Definitely more fancy dress. Absolutely. I've got a few cosplay outfits already sorted out for that one.
Well, I was thinking we're going to talk about your careers for a bit, and then there's some questions from the audience. So first question I was going to ask, like, who were your main musical influences growing up?
Well, I used to listen to ABBA.
Good choice.
Yeah, I think it's a great choice as well.
It's a good choice.
So, yeah, I mean, in all honesty, they're really good composers, aren't they?
Mm, brilliant.
So they were a big influence. And I also used to listen to a lot of classical music like Beethoven and Tchaikovsky and people like that. So a lot of Russian composers.
Unfortunately, I'm not that intelligent, so I listen to mostly heavy metal, usually. So I guess for me, if it's like Judas Priest, Saxon, Iron Maiden, Van Halen, Queensryche, I do like Nightwish these days. So that kind of stuff is what I used to like. And also, I kind of, after the first Batman film that Danny Elfman composed, I loved that score to the first Batman movie. And so that kind of got me into listening to more score-based stuff. And that was the first that kind of score that I actually bought and played it in the car over and over again. I thought that was amazing. And I was you know, a bit like Dave, I was classically trained. I played trumpet, you know, I did that for years and went through school, went to music college and all the rest of it. So I played in orchestras and stuff. But so I guess a bit of both, really, but mostly metal.
I mean, you know, to be fair, when I got older, I did listen to a lot of rock music.
He did stuff. Indeed.
I went through the phase.
I've seen the pictures.
Yeah. That's before I got into EDM.
So. I was wondering then, you had a background in music and you mentioned classical training and stuff. How important is that? Do you think if you're starting a career in music, can you come from that background, but also another? Just
I bet we're going to get different answers here. You go.
Well, I mean, as for classical training, I had piano lessons when I was a kid. Then I started playing trumpet and went to join Ratby Brat Bass. Ratby Brass Band. So
in Ratby. Martin,
yes. And then I decided to play drums in a punk band. And I did that for years because it was more fun than playing the piano. So that was my background. And it wasn't until I started working at Rare, when I was about 18 or 19 years old, that I started listening to a lot of soundtrack stuff.
I've got to say, I don't think it's important to have any kind of musical training whatsoever. I think if you want to get involved in it and do it, you should just do it, right? I don't think me spending 4 years at the Royal London College of Music doing a music degree made any difference to me at all. Like all the stuff that I got taught there, I just thought was boring. And the one thing I took away from the college was the college orchestra rehearsed every Tuesday and Thursday mornings from 9 till 1. And I never missed those rehearsals in 9 years. In fact, 4 years, I used to just sit and watch them and listen to the music. So I kind of feel like if you can hear it, you can write it. So I don't think you need any immediate education. We know tons of composers that can't read music and haven't got a clue, but they write great music.
So kind of surrounding yourself with music.
Yeah, I don't think it matters. I think you just need to do it. Get stuck in and do it.
Yeah, I didn't go to college or music school or anything like that. But my education was pretty much at Rare and learnt on the job.
Yeah, prime example. So don't think you need to learn to read music or any of that stuff. Just buy a keyboard, buy a guitar, buy a synth and mess around with it.
Do some YouTube tutorials.
Exactly. And also these days, there's such a lot on YouTube. You can learn such a lot from that. I've learnt tons from YouTube just about mixing stuff and mastering and things. So I feel like there's a wealth of information out there. Just get stuck in.
I was wondering then, how did you get involved with the video game music industry?
Well, I was working at a music shop. That was my first job.
I was going to say, I was working as a waitress.
You see, there was a cocktail when I met you. So I was just working in a music shop and two blokes came in called Tim and Chris Hampton. They had a company called Ultimate Play the Game and they were setting up this company called Rare Limited. And I was demonstrating some equipment to them and they basically bought the equipment and me. And that's how I got into it. So you could say it was a bit fluky, but I'd learned how to program the actual equipment that I was demonstrating. So it was a logical progression.
Oh, yeah. So I guess I went to university, well, not music college for 4 years, and I left there 22. And I spent the next 11 years playing in rock bands, really, off, on and off unemployment, you know, most of the time. Some bands did well, some bands did terribly. And I had a mate called Robin Beanlands, who was a keyboard player in one of the local bands that I played at. And one day he announced he'd got a job at Rare. I think Dave interviewed him and gave him the job.
I did.
And he'd been about a year and a half. He said to me, "Grant, you know, you've been on unemployment for about 11 years, because I had been on and off." He said, "You know, why don't you try do what I'm doing?" I was like, "I suppose I could try." So I bought a bit of gear, bought a synthesizer and a keyboard and a copy of Cubase. And I spent like 1994... writing music that I thought was appropriate for video games. I sent Rare 5 cassette tapes, never got a reply. And out of the blue, I got a letter saying, come for an interview. And Dave interviewed me and foolishly gave me the job. You know, so it was, like Dave said, it's a complete fluke. I kind of feel like so much, many of us fell into it by a complete fluke. Like I had no idea what I was doing. I spent 11 years playing in bands, getting nowhere, and thought I'd end up a tramp, really. That's what I thought at the end of it all. And Dave thankfully hired me.
There we go.
And it regrets it ever since.
So, and unfortunately, we didn't get kicked out onto the street.
That's so, right.
But
yeah.
We did come from the gutter.
Yeah, and, we did.
You know, but at least we're here now.
So when you first started kind of making music for video games, what's it like compared to making music now with the tools and how it's changed the methods of creating it?
For me, I feel like I write music the same now as I did when I started. Back at Rare in 1995. Like, I'm not a very intellectual composer, so I just kind of mess around until I hear something that I like. I'll load up a sample, a clarinet, or a synthesizer, or whatever, and try and get like, some chords or a melody, and then just, you know, step by step, just build it up into whatever you can.
Tech-wise, has those samplers changed?
The quality's better. So, you know, back then we had like, it's pretty crap quality, but you get these big, huge sample libraries now, which sound like live orchestras and all that stuff. So, and you know, you can buy this stuff. You could get the BBC Symphony Orchestra, the library that I use, the professional model, you can get the core version for like $50. Mm. And it gives you access to all the orchestra instruments, right? So anybody, any one of you could buy that for $50. You can sit at home with it and you can get together orchestral sounds. It means people can, you know, some people are frightened about trying to get stuck in doing that stuff. You just can, it's cheap to buy the base version and you can mess around with it.
By contrast, Grant's first job was putting music, he was converting the stuff from the SNES on Donkey Kong Country 2.
That's right.
Onto GBA, so it was a really poor sound chip. It had four monophonic channels. It had a noise channel, which went ch-ch-ch-ch. There was a triangle channel, which sounds like an owl hooting. And then there's two really nasty pulse wave channels. And that it was as basic as that. And so Grant had asked me, I'd asked Grant to convert this music. And I think the first day you were quite put off, weren't you?
Yeah, because like my first, as I got to Rare, like I thought I'd be using MIDI files like I was at home, right? And then Dave came in and said, yes, so your job's to convert Donkey Kong Country 2, Dave, which is a fantastic score, to work in the original Game Boy. And I was like, all right, that sounds interesting. And he said, yeah, this is what you have to use. I was like, oh my God. It's like, it was just like four, you know, like a black and white screen with numbers on it. And Dave went, yeah, you do it like this. Right, see ya.
Exactly.
And I was like, Jesus Christ, this is. I thought I have to resign. I thought it's just way too hard.
So what we were doing, we were typing hex numbers and codes into an assembler. We'd assemble it and we'd have to wait a minute or two and then it would play it back to us. So there was no playing on the keyboard. We were just like, got the note on the keyboard, typed it in, assembled it, it would play it back to us. So it was a very, very long-winded process. Fortunately, things have come on a little bit since then.
Yeah, but I just have to say, Dave was brilliant at that. And I just, you know, when you showed it, it was just like, it looked like science fiction to me. It was so hard.
It's a bit like playing Battletoads or something like that. You forget how hard a process is. If you're used to doing it and you do it every day, then when somebody new comes and they're going, oh my God, so it was tough.
So I got him back the next day and said, look, Dave, I really can't do it. Can you just show me again? And I wrote it down. So that's first step, step one, press this, step two. So I wrote it on a big long list and then I finally got my head around it in the end.
Which is a good job because we got so much work and so many tunes. You know, we couldn't afford not to have a composer. So I'm glad you stuck at it.
What were your setups like then? I know there were some games companies where people were bringing in their own equipment from home and they were using their own sample sets and stuff and having to source stuff.
We had Amstrad computers at that point, like an Amstrad 40 or something with 40 megabytes of... That was cutting edge then.
Was that all hooked up with MIDI and...
Not really, no. We didn't. We were only using the MIDI to demo songs, really, at that point. But it was just typing, you know, listening to a pitch or getting a chord and typing numbers in. It was as basic as that.
Wow, so it was just an Amstrad. Did you have keyboards in there or
we had a keyboard, but nothing too fancy. We probably have a general MIDI module which had sort of sounds of trumpets, pianos, everything across the board, but nothing that sounded really like a piano or a trumpet.
Do you think also like size limitations really help with creativity? You know, having to do something in such a small space?
I think you're always, obviously you're constrained by the limitations, so you're always trying to stretch those limitations, and that's really important because we were competing against everybody else who was, as we still are, who's making video games, and if you had an edge or a slight edge and you could make it sound better than somebody else, you'd sell a whole load more, so it kept us in job for another week. So, you know.
Now, I do feel like, you know, even though we complained at the time about the memory limitations, I do think it does make you be a bit more inventive. I think you have to, I hate that phrase, think outside the box, but I think you had to. You're like, you know, you had to kind of, how are we going to make this sound even half decent, you know, like, you know.
And also it was a good training as well, because when you've only got four channels or eight channels, and that's just eight sources, eight notes totally, you've got it's a good foundation for composition. You've really got to think about the harmonic structure, about creating a good melody that's strong, that people can latch onto, and then putting a rhythm behind it. So all the time, even though you've only got something very basic, you're learning about mixing, you're learning about harmonies, melodies, and putting chords and chord structures and putting a whole process together. And that served as well even to today. So it was a good founding.
Yeah, and I do feel like these days you can get these great giant synths. You can put one finger on the keyboard and it just sounds amazing. It's got this great huge swath of sound, you know, going on. And I do feel like it's really easy these days to create something that sounds amazing but is unremarkable. And I think that something we were told time and time again back in the day by the Timmy Kristampovs to say, write a good memorable tune, a good memorable melody that people can remember. Because I still feel like the average person in the street likes to whistle a tune on the way to work in the morning, or, you know, kind of thing. And there's not too many times you hear ambient tracks at number one in the charts, right? Because no one can remember it, you know. So if Lady Gaga's a top hit, it's because it's got a good tune you can remember. So I think we were at that beaten into us from early on, that you write a good tune, a good hook, something that you can remember. And I feel like it's stood us well over our careers, really, because people know us for writing memorable tunes. We do our best, you know, but I mean, I feel like that's important.
Also, it's very hard to write a ambient tune when you've only got those limitations. So, you know, we had to find some good melodies that people could latch onto.
Did you feel a bit overwhelmed when it like went to a CD soundtrack, or you kind of had to figure, I've got too much choice with this, you know? or you were like, this is great, I can do
it. Oh yeah, it was, as the technology improved, it was like a big relief every time, oh, we can do this now, I've wanted to do this for years, I'll get on and do it. And so it was like being given a box of chocolates and stuffing your face full.
Mm. I do feel like sometimes, you know, with the stuff I've got now, which is amazing, it brings its own set of problems. Because, like, you know, when you're writing orchestral stuff, you have to make sure it sounds a bit out of tune and a bit out of time, because that's what human beings do, right? Human beings don't play everything in time. And remember that when you're writing a flute part, you know, you've got to have a gap, because a flute player takes a breath. If you write a flute part that's got no gaps in it, it sounds unnatural. You can't quite work out why. It's because flute players, like any wind player, has to take a breath. You have to put a stop there, imagine taking a breath, and then play it again. And when you're writing electronic music, it can be perfectly in time and great and perfectly in tune. But when you go for your looking for a bass sound, you've got 10 million bass sounds to go through and to find the one you want, right? And it's just, you know, that's also a pain in the ass. So I feel like everything's got problems, whether it's modern or old, there's something about it you don't like, you know.
And another thing, again, the limitations had taught us was that if you just play a note on a keyboard, you get a ding, and it's very static. So we had to learn how to modulate that sound to give it a bit of a wobble, or to bring the sound in slowly and let it fade off naturally, have a bit of a pitch wobble on it. So you'd be emulating, even if it was on an NES or a GBA, you'd be emulating how the instruments would physically work in real life. And again, then now we've got these big libraries. You've still got to play it, so you're always modulating or massaging the sound to try and get a realistic performance. So when we're doing stuff, we could quantize it, but it sounds mechanical. It sounds really boring. So all the time we're trying to massage a performance, so that when we've got a flute sound or we've got a clarinet sound, we want it to perform like a clarinet or a flute or a guitar, whatever instrument we're using.
How tough was it to kind of, you know, get inspiration for a soundtrack, and how much would you like play a game or have references that you were given and draw from other things as well?
Oh, first of all, when we're writing, ideally we get a video, or we'd actually get a copy of the game that we can actually physically play. But the inspiration really comes from, you know, somebody like Kev coming in and he's got a character and you think, yeah, that's great. And instantly you're getting ideas for music. Then somebody brings a background in with these wonderful looking graphics, and instantly it starts firing the imagination. So the inspiration isn't hard to get. It comes very, very quickly. It's turning that inspiration and those initial ideas into something that's presentable to a client and ultimately people who play the games.
Yeah, and I feel like these days any composer worth a salt, you know, someone comes to us and says, it's a frozen ice castle or something like that. My mind's thinking straight away, I need spiky things to represent the ice. So like a glockenspiel or a celeste or pizzicato strings, that sounds like spiky ice to me. Or if it's a warm forest, I'm thinking about bassoons or cellos. Or, you know, I think that we all just close our eyes and let your imagination, because it is about telling a story, isn't it?
Yeah,
so you just close your eyes and think, what's that sound like to me? You know, and I think the inspiration isn't the hard part. I think that you get that quite fast, like Dave says. I just think it's trying to find that tune that's good. You know, like when we're, and you never really know until someone else hears it. You might write something, you love it, and everyone thinks it's shit.
Yeah, so, that's true. And consequently, you might write something that you hate.
Yeah.
And then you have to live with it forever because somebody thought it was good and, you know, suddenly for years, well, decades, they say, oh, that's a great tune. You're thinking, it's so not. But be careful what you put down.
I bet there's some bands with one-hit wonders that are just like...
really they might be, and they might have to play it every night.
Yeah, forever, yeah.
Fortunately, we've written a lot of games.
Well, do you think video game music is kind of growing in acceptance and people are regarding it a lot higher these days?
Well, I think just from last night, the amount of thank you everybody for coming last night, but the fact that so many people are interested in music and coming to see us perform, I think that says it all. And so it's very humbling to be there and to play the tunes that we've worked on over decades, to actually play them to people and to see people enjoying the experience. It's very, that's very cool.
Yeah, and I really believe that video game music has reintroduced your generation to purely instrumental music again. I feel like that was a thing that had kind of, it was just classed as the classical highbrow thing that people don't, you know, that's, they don't want to, they still don't hear that. But video game tunes, it's just tunes. Most of the time, there's no vocals, right? And I kind of feel like there's a whole massive amount of people now, just like my son's 20, and, you know, all he listens to is video game tunes. Not because he's my son, just because that's what he likes. You know, and I think that's fantastic. You know, I think that I feel like the video game music will be the classical music of the future. And that's what I think.
Well, I think it really is, because when I was a kid, my mum, she used to take me to, it was called the Montfort Hall in Leicester, and we'd go and watch classical music. And really, after that period, it almost died out, especially with a lot of guitar bands. And I suppose as that generation got older and disappeared, a lot of the classical music went back, but it's had this big resurgence. So we've got big orchestras playing video game tunes.
Like reimagining soundtracks and having orchestras and all these huge performances. Yeah,
and also, in some respects, it's testament to the music written back then that you can turn it into a live orchestra. Yeah. You know, it's like it shows that there's thought behind the chord sequences and we didn't have the resources to make it into this big giant thing. But when you do it, it completely works because... the thought we put into it.
So and there's nothing that beats going to the Royal Albert Hall or a big concert hall somewhere, and you're listening to your music being played by an orchestra when you first wrote it on the Game Boy. So that's really cool.
Did people kind of look down on video game music back in the...
It's been said 1,000 times, you know, it's all plinks and plonks and stuff like that. And it had that reputation, but I think that's well and truly been buried now.
Yeah, and I also think that there's every kind of genre in video game music. There's anything you want to hear, it's in there somewhere. There's metal to complete classical, it's everywhere, right? It's got every genre in it. It's got tons of vocal tracks now. It's become this great, gigantic force. And I think you constantly hear almost like Game Boy noises in the modern dance tracks. Because you hear people going back and sampling that stuff, don't you, and putting it into dance tracks, because it's bled into everything now. And I feel like... I live in LA, right? And so I'm trying to do film stuff. And you find that the older directors, like Dave says, still think video game music's plink-plonk. You know, they don't understand it's completely changed. But the younger directors are all massive games players.
Yeah,
so they totally get the whole games thing. And I've known a few composers get films from people playing the games and going, I like that, let's hire that guy. You know, so I feel like it's definitely... Sometimes it's still considered to be like movies, you know, younger brother, you know. And I think that that's wrong. I think that... In some respects, I think video game music is better than film music, because a lot of film music these days can be a bit bland. I mean, if you think about the Marvel Cinematic Universe, which is a big, giant, billion-dollar force, like, how many of those tunes can you actually remember? There's not very many. I can remember the Avengers theme tune, because that's like Alan Silvestri, who's an old-school composer who writes great tunes, did Back to the Future. You know, how many of the other Marvel tunes can you remember? I think that's wrong. But you remember plenty of video game tunes, can't you?
But I think with Marvel tunes... They seem to almost take the melodies out now, don't they? And so they're suggesting the feeling with the orchestration, which is great. But the melodies to latch on, they seem to have almost taken them out as a choice, an artistic choice. And that's a shame, because when we were younger, we used to love going to watch John Williams and Star Wars and things like that. They were just such great tunes. And we remember those melodies. And they have that emotional connection with us. So that's the sort of thing that I think it's a shame that those big, strong melodies are almost discouraged now.
I think it's very true. I feel like you go to see a big movie these days, it's very, like I say, epic, but unremarkable. You can't remember it. But it's great. You think it's great at the time. You walk out, I can't remember a note of that. And I guess that may be how people prefer it, but I think we're from the generation where we're like, right. we like to hear a good tune. I mean, if you took away Darth Vader's theme or exactly. Luke Skywalker's theme, it'd be like, ooh, it's not as good, is it? You know, so yeah. I feel like sometimes when directors say, ooh, I don't want to hear a melody, it sort of detracts from the scene. I'm a bit like, you should write a better scene, mate. If that melody's going to detract from your scene, it should be a better scene, you know.
Yeah, so. Need a better, stronger story. Yeah.
Right. So if someone was trying to like enter the video game music world now, what do you think would be a good starting point or any tips?
I think a good starting point would just be to not bother.
To forget it.
Find a different career altogether, to be honest. Because it's a tough gig. It was a tough gig back then. It's even tougher now because there's so many more people wanting to get into it.
Mm.
And it's hard work. You know, there's the romantic side of a video game musician doing lots of video games. It's not like that at all. It's heads down, see you at the end of the scene. And as soon as you finish that one, you're on to the next one. So it's a tough gig.
So, yeah, it's hard. And I think that you have to dedicate your existence to it, right? If you go into it half-assed, it's not going to work. And also, you could be the best composer in the world, right? And you just put your fantastic music on your own website or on YouTube. Like the chance of people seeing it is very unlikely. You have to find, both of us feel like we're flukes getting into the industry, right? Mm. And I feel like everyone that I talk to feels like it's a fluke. And I just think you've just got to find that path somehow. And sitting in your bedroom or whatever, writing your music is going to get you nowhere. I mean, you've got to get out and meet people, come to conventions, go to game jams. You know, you need to be in the same space that the people are doing the thing that you want to do, right? Whatever that is. Get to know people. That's more important. I feel like it's 50% having the talent, but the other 50% is having your networking thing, the people that you know. And that could be like, just bumping into anybody anywhere. Like, you know, my wife says to me, go to everything you can possibly go to, because that one chance meeting, my like you were just saying today, like someone you met here 3 years ago.
So the first time I came to Retro Mesa, there was a gentleman who walked over to me, asked me to sign his copy of whatever it is. And in about 10 days' time, I'm going to continue working for his company that since then have expanded. They've become a lot bigger. And you just do not know who you're going to meet. So that it's... and we used to talk about networking and that kind of thing. We used to go, yeah, whatever. We've got social media. You've actually got to get out there and meet people. And if you want to be a musician as well or a composer, it's no use mingling with people like us because we're your competition. You've got to go and mingle with the games directors, the people who are actually making the games or the people doing the graphics. You've got to make yourself useful to somebody, not another musician, because you're completely useless to them.
Yeah, and also it's not, you know, sometimes I think composers think it's what they can do for you. It's not, it's what you can do for them.
Yeah, exactly.
You are a service industry to the people that run the game, right? It's not the other way around. And so, you know, we spend our time just saying yes to anything. If the guy, can you change it? Yes, no worries. Even if you think you've written the best piece in the world, you just got to change it. Otherwise, they're just going to fire you and find somebody else.
Yeah, and the reason for that is because game development is a dynamic thing. It changes all the time. So you could have done what you think is the best tune in the world. If it doesn't fit with the gameplay, and gameplay is everything in a game, then your music is not working. So you've got to be super adaptable and super willing to change, even, you know, even if you've been in it for decades. Mm. You've got to be up for changing things to suit the gameplay.
Like I can give you two examples. Like my mate Danny Baranowski, who wrote the music for Super Meat Boy and Binding of Isaac and Krypton Necrodancer, he was that guy working in Lowe's, you know, in Home Depot in America, dreaming about being a video game guy. And he got a track on OC Remix. He actually remixed one of my tunes from Perfect Dark. And the guy that wrote a game called Cannibalt heard his music and said, do you want to write music for this game? And Cannibalt sort of launched Danny, got him, and equally, this Daniel Rosenfield, who uses C418 on Twitter, who's the guy that did all the original Minecraft music. Daniel was just a young 18-year-old kid, and when Notch was looking for music in a chat room, said, anybody in this chat room write any tunes? And Daniel was like, I do it. And then he got the gig. I mean, you know, and Daniel's probably the most followed composer in the world, you know, and just from being in the right place at the right time and saying yes. And like, I think we both always say, just say yes to everything, even if you haven't got a clue what it is. Just say yes and go home and Google it and find out what it is. And
there's a lot of like online projects that you can collaborate with and loads of tools to do that now.
Yeah, having that motivation, isn't it? Because you've got to dedicate your existence to it. There's no other way.
How important is it to keep it fun as well with stuff like bands like you had last night and kind of have a bit of a separation from work as well?
I personally think it's essential because in my early career, I was still playing in bands. Mm. And I still enjoy playing in bands. I'm not the best musician in the world, but I really enjoy playing my saxophone or the keyboards. So it's nice to do something that's related, but it's certainly different. And I think that's, for me, I find that really important.
No, it is. I think, and there is a fun side to games, isn't there? It's hard work, but there's, I've spent the last good years working on the Mario Rabbids games, Mario Rabbids, Kingdom Battle, and Sparks of Hope, and I get on great with the creative director Davide and the guys in the Ubisoft Milan, and we have a good laugh. And I feel like, I remember when I was at Rare, typing into Rare to Google like how to be a film composer, something like that. How do you do it? And I remember an article popped up by a guy called Richard Kraft, who I've since met in Los Angeles. He's a very big movie composer agent, Danny Elfman, and all the big boys, you know. And he wrote something, but something that stuck in my mind wasn't. It said something like, "People like composers to be the people that can have a bit of a laugh and have a bit of a giggle and be the bit of a personality, you know, and all that kind of thing. And they like it to be that way. And I feel like even if that isn't your normal personality, because I feel like most composers are quite introvert.
That's where I'm going wrong.
That's right. But I think that you've got to be able to, you know, that BAFTA thing. There's the actors' heads. There's a happy face and the sad face. And I feel like a lot of composers that I know were miserable most of the time. But when it comes to that bit, you need to be in public with people. You can put on that persona, being that, you know, happy, lucky, happy person, and all the rest of it. Even if that isn't you, and I feel like you have to learn to do that. People don't want to deal with introverts, and I know it's hard. And I feel like most musicians are quite introvert, really. We sit in dark and roomy most of the day, not talking to anybody, you know, for 8 hours a day or 10 hours a day writing music. We don't want to talk to anybody. But I think you have to be able to put on that personality that probably isn't you, but you've got to have the outward skin. So when people talk to you, they can work with you.
And that's the thing about playing in bands, because it forces you to be sociable. You're entertaining people. So that aspect is quite important for that side of thing.
Definitely.
So just being Billy No Mates, slaving away in your room, isn't going to work out for you.
No.
Is it important to explore different culture sounds as well and not just stick within your area? I know, David, a lot of your tunes have been kind of from different cultures and, you've got more of a less kind of traditional video game sound with your stuff.
Well, I guess so, but that's purely because I get bored doing the same thing. So if you can explore something, I don't know, from the Indian subcontinent, then that's great. And then you're learning new scales. I did a soundtrack for a Saudi prince not so long ago, and I had to learn how to write music using a different scale.
Mm.
And it just invigorates your music. It's giving you a totally different feel, different way of working. So if the more of that, the better, really.
Yeah, and also the more strings to your bow you have, the more employable you are, right? If we used to get CDs to Rare, people sending in dance music tracks, which were all fantastic, but it's a bit like, that's good for one thing. If you can write lots and lots of different styles, it's like having a machine gun with bullets in it. The more bullets you have that you can fire out with more different things, the more chance you're going to get employed. If you've got one bullet and one thing you do, you're going to miss the target, maybe. So it's best to be able to, and especially video games, you get asked to write the most ridiculous things you've ever heard of, from complete this to complete that. You know, you've got to be able to be versatile, make sure you can write lots of different things. And also, one of the things I did learn at college was that, I think it was Haydn or Mozart or whatever it was. I think Haydn's before Mozart, I forget. But anyway, I feel like one of them learned to write symphony form by studying the other person's stuff. So he took Haydn's symphony form and realised it was the A idea, the B idea, the development section, whatever it is, and he just pulled all his music out and put your music in there and see what you learn how it works. So like us, we have to write a pop track or whatever it is, and you might... Or Metallica track, you get a Metallica track, you work out, here's the verse, here's the middle eight, here's the chorus, and you can work, you can see the structure, and then you put your music, it's like take the meat off the skeleton, then put your meat on that skeleton. So you learn how it works, so if after a reggae track, which I don't like reggae, I don't listen to it, but you know, if I had to do it, I'm sure Dave, you'd listen to it, wouldn't you? You work out how it works.
I used to listen to a lot of Bob Marley when I was a kid. I actually like that kind of stuff.
But it's true, you can. Yeah. That's how you work it out, isn't it? You listen to the track, work it out, and put your own things in the skeleton, you know.
And that doesn't stop. So constantly, we're always analysing stuff. So when we listen to music, we're not kind of getting the emotional vibe. We're probably listening to the the chord structure, the instrument structure, how it's working, the tempo of the thing, or it doesn't stop. You never turn it off, really, which is a shame because it's not really until we're on a night out in a club or something where you actually listen to music for the sake of listening to music, and it's in, you know, it's because we're so analytical. And the other thing that we do, well, I'm sure Grant does the same thing, we hone in on certain frequencies to listen to, say, what the bass guitar's doing, or and so you get so used to it, you'll miss the rest of the track because you're listening to a guitar part.
Isolating it in your mind.
All the time. Mm. So after a while, you do listen to music in a different way.
Yeah. So it's a real difference, really.
Well, one last question before we go to the audience questions. And what are some of the video game soundtracks you guys really enjoy?
What, from other artists?
Yeah.
I really enjoy the Metal Gear Solid soundtracks. I think that's got a great theme. And some of the latest stuff was really quite emotional. And the more emotional, the better, really, for the bigger games. Or if it's a smaller game, I just like fun. It's got to be quirky.
Yeah, I think for me, I feel like Zelda Link to the Past is my favourite soundtrack of all time. I just think that's a fantastic piece of music. I remember playing that game and just thinking, oh, this is brilliant, you know. So I think that's my favourite that I really like. I think some of the modern soundtracks, sometimes, you know, they are a bit unremarkable. They sound fantastic and epic, but I can't remember any of it. And I think the ones that stand out to everyone are the ones that I've got a great big tune that we can remember, you know, whatever, or something quirky, catchy about it. So I do feel like, I don't think I listen to a ton of music, video game music. I've been listening to more film scores, probably. That's what I listen to more. And I kind of think I don't listen to video game scores because if I want to write my own stuff, I want to try and pull it out of my own head.
Yeah.
And I think it's inevitable you're going to copy something somebody else. You always do. But you try to, you know, keep it in your own brain.
Yeah. Well, the sources we want are the sources that mean something to us.
Yeah.
So it's not about listening to, other game composers. It's it's a different source of inspiration.
Mm.
Awesome. Well, can we get a round of applause for David Wise and Grant Kirko?
Cheers.
And if anybody has any questions, put your hand up and we've got a roving mic.
Here he is.
Come around. Yeah.
So I was just thinking about what do you think of the availability of video game music in many different soundtracks, especially Nintendo? Is widely unavailable for most people to listen to outside of pirate uploads on YouTube or other sites.
Yeah, I don't know why they do that. Like, Nintendo is particularly funny about that. I don't know why. I don't know whether they don't care about it. It just seems they never want to release anything. We were just talking about that today, actually. It's a weird thing why they don't want to do it. I feel like Nintendo have got such a massive wealth of great music. Why on earth they don't stick it out on Spotify and everything else? I don't know why. It seems crazy to me. There's no work. All you have to do is upload the WAV files. It's not very difficult. I don't know why they don't do it.
Or even vinyl releases, which we're seeing on there.
Yeah, I think
video soundtracks.
We get a lot of people and they'll buy vinyl because they want something tactile to say, well, you know, I love the game, I'm supporting it, and they come to a show like this, they want the composer to sign it. It's because it means something to them. And if a company isn't releasing them, I do think they are missing out on that emotional connection with the game, and the player, which is a shame. So hopefully one day they might change that.
Yes, the Nintendo are particularly bad at it. It seems they're the worst to me. And sometimes we both run into the situation where someone's wanted to perform our soundtracks live with an orchestra and Nintendo tried to stop them doing it. And so they do seem to do that quite a lot. And I don't really know why. I actually can't legally do it anyway, but it crops up every now and then, and we both kind of go, what's the harm in it? You know, it just seems crazy to us, so I don't know.
Are there any other questions?
Hi.
Oh.
So, you've been talking a lot about melodies, and you've both written some really great, beautiful melodies over the years. From my experience, it's very difficult to write that beautiful melody. So, what is your approach to, writing a good melody?
My approach is, once I've got a melody I'm okay with, I will just put it on repeat and repeat, and it's that kind of small changes, big gains type of thing. So I'll listen to it until it really starts to grate and annoy me, and I'll start moving things really slightly and trying. It's got to be liquid, it's got to flow. And if you listen to something 200 times, it becomes apparent if the melody is just needs a bit of tweaking. And so I might spend days on a melody just tweaking, until suddenly it'll fall into place. You go, that's it, and get on with it. But I mean, some come really quickly, but a lot of them do take a lot of repeat and listening to it over and over again, especially if it's an important game theme. You really want that to be right, because you'll be using that a lot throughout the game. So that's my approach. Put it on repeat until it annoys you.
Also, there's little tricks about writing melodies. Like, if you listen to the greats kind of thing, like if you, for instance, take the melody to E.T., right, which goes da 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 da. We all know that, right? The next phrase is da 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 da, which is the same rhythm but different notes. So this trick, like John Williams, is, you know, it's very classically like, here's the melody, here's the rhythm, here's the same rhythm, slightly different notes, and da 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 da, same rhythm again, different notes, da 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 da. And so, you know, like something like Harry Potter, is Peter Pan score. That's da 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 da. Da-na, da-na, da-da-da-da, da-na, da-na, da-da-da-da. So he's repeating things subtly, so it gets lodged in your brain, right? So melody writing, like Dave said, it's a little bit like you've got to have enough repetition in it that it hooks it. If you write a completely meandering piece of melody, no one's going to remember it. It's quite simplistic in some ways. You have to make sure you've got little repeating things in it that sticks in people's brains. And I feel like we both learned that really early on, because we kept getting told, listen to Nintendo, and you could see how they have stuff that you just couldn't get out of your head. So there's little techniques like that help reinforce that. So you might try and write something all over like this, which is maybe impressive, but no one can remember it. Stick to those little things, little repetition, similar notes, similar patterns, and it sticks.
I think when you start analysing melodies as well, you'll realise what a short range that main core melody is written in. There won't be many notes in it, and it's a good exercise to do. And once you start analysing and realise it doesn't really stray far and it's in complete structures, then when you start using those kind of rules in your own music, suddenly it starts to get a lot simpler for other people to understand, because really it's about singing a melody to somebody else. You want them to sing it back to you.
Yeah, well, I think we're going to actually end it there. Thank you, guys.
All right, yes, thank you. Cheers.